everyone, and welcome to Historia Canadiana. My name is Patrick, and with me, as always, is the most amazing co-host in the whole wide world, Mackenzie.
Oh, you make my heart warm every time.
Especially in this winter season. Mac, we actually have something even more special today.
We do.
I know. The only thing, I might be a bit worried because he's an Edmonton Oilers fan, and, you know, we're two guys from Montreal. I don't think we should bring it up too much, but I'm just warning you. Our guest today is an Oilers fan.
I thought the warning was going to be that he's going to sound a lot smarter than we do on the usual.
That's a definite possibility. A shoelace on the side of the highway sounds smarter than us. But, you know, today we have with us none other than Craig from Canadian History X. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here. And even though I'm an Oilers fan, my second favorite team is the Montreal Canadiens. So,
hey!
I mean, that's already leagues above my favorite hockey team, which is none because I don't watch hockey.
Yeah, I'm only a Canadiens fan because if I'm not, I get disowned. So
that's, yeah, pretty much. Yeah. I think I go out of my way to like Toronto sometimes just to screw with my dad. Craig is the host of not one, not two, but three Canadian history podcasts. One's on hockey, one's on the prime ministers, and one is on, I guess, general Canadian history, right? So
why don't you tell us
a bit about those.
The first one mentioned was hockey. So that's Pucks and Cups, and it looks at the early history of hockey. I've always found that very interesting. The 40s, the 50s, even farther back to the 1910s, 1920s, when it was a really rough and wild game. And so I like talking about the history of those days before it kind of became this very corporate type of game that it is now. And then from John to Justin is, I look at every single prime minister from Sir John A. Macdonald all the way to Justin Trudeau. Right now, this week, it's going to be Louis Saint Laurent. And it's a really interesting episode. And then the main one, the flagship, is Canadian History X, where I look at everything from the guy who tried to jump the St. Lawrence in a rocket car to rebellions to Mr. Dress-Up to everything. Whatever interests me, I do an episode on.
Right. Awesome. Every time I see your show written out, the main show, I almost say X, and it bugs me every time. Because Mac, I don't know if you've ever seen it written out, but it's EHX.
Yeah, I've seen it. I'm getting the joke now. I was like, what? Why is it so bad? And I was like, wait a minute. Oh, God.
It seemed like a good idea at the time when I named it.
Today, we're continuing a part of our chronology that we've been kind of setting up. We tend to do the show in chronological order. And Craig agreed to come on with us to talk about some really important changes that happened in Canada in the 1840s. Mostly in the 1840s. So we'll be talking today about mainly two things, and if we get there, we'll talk about other stuff, but we're mostly going to be talking about the Act of Union and the attribution of responsible government in British North America. But just to kind of set us up, we may have spoken about the 1830s for, 12 episodes at this point?
Somebody is a little obsessed with the 1830s, but that's a different conversation.
I will not apologize for that. So I guess just might as well use the opportunity that we have a guest. Craig, do you mind setting us up? What kind of the context was before the Act of Union? Why was it deemed necessary?
The main reason is because you guys had two major rebellions in 1837 and 1838, the Lower Canada and Upper Canada rebellions. And that was really because, A, there was a desire for some to have a republic like the United States, and that's why we got the Republic of Canada on a really small little island in the Niagara River that did not last very long. And it was actually set up by the grandfather of William Lyon Mackenzie King. So there's all these cool connections to like the 20th century and everything. Mm-hmm. But we had these rebellions. We had things like the Battle of Saint-Eustache, which is what's on my screen behind me. And it ended up creating what was called the Durham Report, which created the union of the province of Canada. And in many ways, the province of Canada leads directly, or not in many ways, in a very direct way, it leads to Confederation and the creation of Canada. And even though it happened, we're coming up on 200 years ago, we're still feeling the effects of what happened with those rebellions and how much they did shape Canada.
Yeah, absolutely. As we're going to kind of see, Durham suggested many things in his report, not just the union of the two Canadas. That was one of the things, among others. But the basic idea was exactly that, right? To create this more unified province in many ways, shape, or forms, economically, socially, politically.
Culturally assimilation. Yeah. We're still paying for that suggestion.
I mean, that's just living under an empire for you, I guess. Yeah. So. But yeah, as we're going to see, the Act of Union is kind of an attempt to bring that into effect. Mm-hmm. So yeah, Mac, that's always a common question that we start the show with is, what do you know about the Act of Union?
The Act of Union is actually one of the things I studied in high school, okay. Just because it is, again, such an important document, an important moment in Canadian history, trying like this act of unifying Lower and Upper Canada and just sort of distinguishment as its separate territory, I guess, in the within the British Empire. So yeah, it was something that I did learn. It's going to come back to me as we go more than anything else. But this is definitely an area where I have a bit more. But again, like high school background knowledge.
Right.
So it's going to be very slanted, biased in certain lights.
As it tends to be.
Yeah.
So I guess the best way to start, I thought it would be really fun. There's this book I have that's called Egotists and Autocrats, which is written by a poet originally, but it's a history book. He's written by a poet from BC called George Bowering. And he basically, this will actually interest you, Craig, he basically goes over and makes commentaries on all the prime ministers of Canada kind of like this really fun way. And he has like a small chapter at the beginning where he talks about the province of Canada, because he makes the argument that, well, there were prime ministers before John A. Macdonald. And basically, he sums up in about a paragraph what things were like as the Act of Union was being put into place. And to me, it kind of represents almost just the flippant nature of doing this. It was just like, well, here, now you're just kind of doing this now. And I think it'll help set us up for basically talking about the Act of Union. So he goes on to say, on February 10th, 1841, at Lord Sydenham's house, a glorious house in Montreal, there was proclaimed an earlier act of confederation, although that was not the original plan. There was a lot of snow outside, and horse buns were freezing as soon as they landed in it. And the date was auspicious with optimism. It was young Queen Victoria's first wedding anniversary. It was also the christening day for her first child, who was called Little Vicky. It was also the third anniversary of the cancellation of Lower Canada's constitution. What a day, the loyal English businessmen of Montreal rejoiced. So to me, this kind of sets up a lot of the elements that become integral to the Act of Union. Because as you were saying, Mac, a big part of this and like the Durham Report and eventually this is assimilation, right? And something that Bowering kind of points to in this is that we're often thinking about at this moment, what does Queen Victoria do? What is the governor doing in his glorious mansion? What do the merchants of Montreal, who are very English, think about this? And the French, I guess, get some form of democracy back because we no longer have their government on hold with a special council. Well, so
to me, yeah. To me, it almost seems like they didn't know what to do with this little Upper and Lower Canada that was sitting there. You know, they lost their main holding of North America, the 13 colonies. Mm-hmm. And then they were there with, we have furs. And that was about it. And they sort of had to figure out what else they were trying to do with this little cold area that they had. That's mm-hmm. this filled with little angry Frenchmen.
I mean, wow. But yeah,
an oversimplification, obviously, sure. But
yeah, I guess so. I think the idea was also an elitism, right? Mm. It's this idea of saying, well, you have this really big province, right, with what would later become Quebec, with this really big territory, and there's a lot, as you say, of French people, and they really have quite a lot of pull in this unified empire that we're trying to build. So exactly that, right? I don't think you're that far off in saying that there's this constant struggle of what exactly do you do with this, right? Mm. We can't exactly constantly alienate them, although that's exactly what would happen for a lot of this. But, you know, it goes kind of against everything we're trying to build to let them just be on their own. I don't think you're that far off in saying that. Yeah.
Oh no, for sure. Cause, and I think one of the things I think interesting to point out again is it's a colony of a colony. which is always something fascinating to me involving New France and all that. Take, for example, again, the 13 colonies, when they colonized it, there was the First Nations people that were there. And then they sent in their own people, and that was what became Americans. The French came over, colonized the First Nations, then the English came over, recolonized the First Nations, but then also began colonizing the French. But the English can't do what they did to the First Nations at that time because of that belief that they are still part of the Euro. They're still part of the European. So they can't do the same total ruining and reckoning that happened to the First Nation in that sort of European centrist mindset. They still have to treat these Frenchmen as Europeans. Can't do what they usually do. They have to find a different way. They have to do a different plan almost, which then leads to things like the Durham Report.
Totally. Yeah.
I think like you mentioned with the elitism of the English and especially the English merchants, when we had the rebellions, you know, the 1837 rebellion in Lower Canada, and then that kind of inspired the Upper Canada rebellion. So it could have also been they saw the French as influencing the English. The English wouldn't have rebelled if the French hadn't rebelled. Mm-hmm. So by having this province of Canada, and even though the French Canada outnumbered English Canada 2-1, is if you control the government, you control the people. So much easier to keep rebellions from happening if we just kind of lump everybody together, but make sure that, you know, the English Canadians, they're the ones in charge, because they didn't want to rebel in the first place. They just followed what the French were doing. And I think that might have been part of the mindset. It seems like kind of a half-assed approach to fixing a problem, really.
Oh, yeah. I think that was a recurring theme in our discussion at the rebellions. Britain just trying to do what Britain always does and then slipping at the starting line.
But yeah, so if we look at what the Act of Union actually entails, right? We have a vague idea of what it says. We've been kind of alluding to it. But if we look at what it actually does systematically or structurally, there are a few points that we can look at in the actual Act of Union, which is available freely online. If you're a masochist listening and want to read through it all, you totally can. But in essence, right in point 3 of the Act of Union, they pretty much describe what is going to happen. And that is, if I quote right, the reunion of the two said provinces, in which there will be one legislative council, one assembly. Essentially, they'll be voting for one law, one peace, one welfare, one good government. And good government is basically their way of saying that they'll be representing the monarchy in Canada. Right? That was kind of the idea of a lot of this rhetoric. Whenever they refer to good government, is basically the monarchical system within Canada, in this kind of proto-democracy that wasn't really that much of a democracy.
Right? Oh, no.
That's pretty much the point. And as we mentioned earlier, the Special Council, which had kind of removed any even semblance of democracy in Lower Canada, that would be abolished. And so, in essence, you have people that can vote for the... they can vote for the House of Assembly, and you have 84 seats in there, right? Half that represent Canada East and half that represent Canada West. And you have what is essentially a higher house, which is a council that's chosen by the Governor General, right? Who at the time of the Act of Union, as I mentioned with the George Bowering quote, was Lord Sydenham. And that's basically what it looks like. Now we'll get into how that actually operates, but that's pretty much the gist of it. 84 seats that are elected and a council that directly is chosen by the governor. Now I'll give you both 3 guesses to say how much influence that elected house actually had on the governor.
I'm guessing about 0.
Wow, ding, you win the grand prize there, Greg. Okay. As might surprise no one, the actual assembly did not have that much power. Right? They could have, right? The governor could have chosen, in this case, whether it was Sydenham or later Cathcart or whatever, they could have chosen to listen to these elected officials, but they did not, preferring to choose to listen to a bunch of aristocrats that they chose themselves. And why wouldn't they, honestly? I mean, They told them what they wanted to hear, and it kept the system running as it had for centuries at that point.
I want to comment just for a second on the actual wording of this thing.
Yep.
It is meant for an English person to read and not a French person.
Okay.
No, it's I know it's a weird comment to make, but it's one of the subtle things that happened of how they were trying to implement their plans, you know, because if they make these documents in such a way that a Frenchman whose second language is English is unable to read it, if you can't read it, you can't know what it's saying. If you don't know what it's saying, you can't argue against it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the final line of point of the preamble, mm-hmm. under the name aforesaid, upon, from, and after the day so appointed as aforesaid. I don't even know what that means. I study like middle and old English for my degree, but I don't know what it means.
I mean, yeah, that's fair. And it kind of brings up one of the integral parts of this Act of Union and this new Canada that's being built is the official languages, because already at that mm-hmm. point, it was an issue. And pretty much the official language policy, I guess you can say, is that you can debate in the House in both English and French. Like, that's acceptable. You can actually speak English or French. However, as you succinctly pointed out, Mac, the official documentation is all in English. Right? Mm-hmm. Every official decision is made in English by English governors, in this case, by an English cabinet. So all those official policies are in English. And that has a definite effect, no matter how much debate you have in French. You could have the entire debate in French if you want. If it's written in English, it certainly has an effect on policy going forward.
Yeah, and translation issues aside, it's just the wording alone. It's also the people who are debating in French, how can they be 100% sure that what they're saying is being translated properly as well?
I'm sure that was an issue. I've never looked up if that became like a genuine point of contention.
It was never a major point of contention, but it's the compiling of these minor slights and tiny things, you know, it's these tiny details that then add up to the larger whole of why these issues arose.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
So it's never going to be a major point in history of bad translation, but it's probably, in my opinion, I think it is something that probably became a factor.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
They definitely seem to have like overcomplicated the language in this document, it seems, just to make it as confusing as possible. Because like you said, reading it, like it's just, even just reading it now, there's so many commas and just like one long sentence of just, you know, it's like reading really dry religious text or something like that, where you're just trying to, and then by the time you get to like the end of, you know, point three, you're like, what was the beginning of point three again? Like, I'm so confused by this point. And I want to touch on, you mentioned with the Governor General, like when we think of the Governor General now, it's such a figurehead position. They kind of have power, but not really.
Mm-hmm.
But back then, like, you know, they wanted responsible government after the rebellions. And what they got was pretty much almost a dictatorship with the Governor General kind of calling most of the shots under the guise of, okay, you can elect these people, but I don't have to listen to them. I can do whatever I want. And I'm going to listen to people who live in England who never come here.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, coming back to one of the demands after the rebellions, right, or within this concept, one of the things that Durham himself was recommending was a representation by population, right? This thing that's mostly associated with like an American mindset that, oh, you know, that was part of an integral part of the American Revolution of
no taxation that was, without representation.
Exactly. You know, that's one of the things that Durham said. It's like, you can unite, you should unite, right? For obvious purposes, for pacification purposes, but you should also give an actual representation according to scale, right? And part of that was with the idea that there was going to be a lot more English immigration, right? And eventually it was going to overpower a lot of the voices, but the idea had a sound basis nonetheless, right? This idea of actually giving the population a voice that was, you know, worthy of their strengths, right? Worthy of their mass. And that's not something that they would really ever do. As you know, as I mentioned, the assembly is split exactly in two. Everything is given exactly the equal amount of say and pull. Obviously, it would only become an issue once the English would grow to a bigger population in Canada West.
Shift in demographics.
Then it would become an issue of rep by pop. Then it would be a really important thing. But before that, Well, it's fine. It's fine to have like half-half. We're not going to talk about it too much.
It'd be like today if we kind of split Canada in two right at the border of Manitoba and Ontario and said, okay, there's whatever, there's 330 seats in the House. We're going to give you each section is going to get the exact same. And it's like Ontario and Quebec outnumber the West immensely. So that it would be like doing that. It would make no sense at all to have something like that. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't make sense back then either.
No, it only makes sense, again, insofar as everything they're operating under is that.
Mm-hmm. It just never needed to make sense, though. They knew that. They knew their power was with their governor general.
I don't know. Do you think? I think they were genuinely operating, like reading some of the official documentation of the time, I think they were genuinely operating under a mindset that they thought it made sense. I think a lot of them did that, operate then. Under that.
Okay. I haven't read the same supporting documents that you have through this.
In the sense, I'm sure it was with also a mindset of like domination. Like, yeah, we want to maintain power and that's fine. Like that's what empires do and governments do. That's the whole point. But I do genuinely think that some of it was done with a genuine belief that they were doing something that made sense. Obviously, as Craig said, it doesn't, right?
they said a lot of things made sense.
But I do genuinely think to some extent it did. I think it just went with the mindset of the time. One thing that I do find really interesting, however, because we've been kind of railing already right off the gate about the Act of Union, I do think there is some positive. Mm-hmm. One of that positive, or I think the potential for a positive, is in another duality that's created, and it's the joint premiership. I think this is a really interesting idea. Now, it's practice leaves to be desired, especially before responsible government is obtained. But I do think that it's an interesting idea. So, Mac, do you know what the joint premiership is, basically?
Well, it was each Canada elected its own premier, right? With the two men then working together?
Yeah, pretty much. Canada East, with all its constituencies, gets to vote a certain premier into power, and Canada West as well. Now, theoretically, there is a difference between the two. There is officially a premier, and I think it was called a deputy premier. But for all intents and purposes, they worked together. That was the goal. Now, Craig, what do you think of this idea? Do you think that it's something that had ever a chance of working within this framework that they were operating under in 1840, 41 at this point?
I think it's kind of like putting two steering wheels on a ship and calling two people captain and hoping that they go the same direction. I mean, in theory, it seems like a really good idea because you're like, well, you both have leaders. They can work together for the common good. But, you know, if one of those leaders is a much more dominating personality or is much more akin to bribery or things like that, then they might, you know, dominate the other one. And then even though the one is a premier and the one's a deputy premier, even just with that distinction, it's like, it's still separating it somewhat. So I think in practice, like, yeah, it is kind of a cool idea, but it would be like today having Aaron O'Toole and Justin Trudeau as co-prime ministers. It would be complete chaos. Nothing would ever get done.
So it's like a minority government. Yeah. Okay.
Essentially. Yeah.
But also, in a sense, what ended up happening, for most of it at least, there were some exceptions. What you saw is basically you either had two conservatives, or like Tories at the time as they were known, or two reformers get elected. It's very rare that you saw, or at least from the cursory glance I looked at, the joint premiers that were elected. It's very rare that you saw two completely opposing views get elected to the same. But this idea, I think, is still has some validity to it, in that it offers the possibility for a discussion. But as you're saying, I don't think either of them kind of want to listen to each other anyway. Looking back at some of these documents, I don't think either the reformers or the Tories were particularly interested in a lot of debate and coalition, right? And even like the major coalitions that we think of throughout Canadian history, it's reform and reform, or Tory and Tory. You never really hear much about Tories and Liberals together. So that kind of falls flat, even in its potential, I guess.
I do think I agree. I'm leaning more on Craig's side of this argument, just the two captains trying to steer the same ship. It is true. If they stuck to the idea of premier and then deputy premier, and then they sort of rotated that basis and the sort of selections of the provincials, I think that would have made more sense. But if in effect they were both a premier, then it makes it makes the positions kind of meaningless in that way. I'd almost think they're in the same way. Again, weird example, but in Russia, you know, there's the president and the prime minister both have separate duties. And then that's how Putin gets to keep going in power because he rotates between the two of them, right?
Sure.
And so that's the sort of idea that you want. You almost want to be different power dynamics so that way people can effectively affect things. They can do real things. It's like if you had a president and a vice president, but they were both essentially the president.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's confirmed the province of Canada is post-Soviet Russia.
Great. I mean, yeah, a little bit.
Looking back on that, like I sometimes have a cynical view of history, especially as we get, you know, farther back in the past, and especially between the English and French.
Totally.
And it could have been that this was kind of a way that the English could keep power, because if you did a case where you had one premier and he was elected by everybody, you know, in Canada East and Canada West, well, because Canada East outnumbers Canada West so much, they're going to elect somebody that is in line with what they want. And that doesn't seem like that's something that obviously the leaders in the province of Canada, the English leaders, wanted. They certainly didn't want to be answering to a French Canadian premier by any means. So it seemed like it was a nice compromise of like, well, each side will have something, but that ensures that the French don't have too much.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess a question going off that, we've been talking a lot about the dichotomies between English and French, right? And it's a bit inevitable to talk about that. I don't think it's a bad thing to bring this up. Do either of you think that there's a different way that we can approach this? Is there a way to dissociate from those intrinsic problems or issues that are raised? Or is it pretty much that's the major takeaway from the Act of Union as it stands right now?
I mean, for shifting the paradigm, one of the things they did that I think actually was a good thing was the renaming East and West Canada versus Upper and Lower Canada. There's a different value system in place there. It's like the debate that goes on with North and South Dakota.
Okay.
It's a small change for sure, but these people, Lower Canada, I always get them confused. Lower Canada was Quebec, or was it? Yeah, exactly. So obviously these French people are thinking to themselves, we are lower.
Even though it was a geographical name and not an actual descriptor.
The geographical and how people feel about these things, though, do people ever end up thinking rationally that this is a geographical consideration? People in North Dakota are still debating the name North and South Dakota, because not because of the fact that North Dakota literally is just a bit farther north. It's just because it brings certain negative connotations to their state.
Mm-hmm. I've never actually heard of that debate, but okay.
Yeah. And so I think it is a very minor change, but the way we talk about things and say things and name things is important. So I think that change between Upper and Lower Canada, simply East and West Canada, was a big one or an important one, just to sort of help change that mindset.
Okay. I think for sure, like you said, there is, looking back at this time, there's special, we have the English-French divide is a huge part of it. I mean, the Upper and Lower Canada were only created in 1791. So there's still a lot of people who remember even just that. And obviously, you know, like the Battle of the Plains of Abraham was 1759. It's still a ways back, but, you know, we still think of things like World War I and even World War II, and that's almost the same amount of distance. So that sort of thing, you have people who are in the house whose parents, you know, parents obviously passed away by that point, but would have remembered the issues with the English and the French and the wars and things like that. So I think that still plays as you get to 1841 and the creation of these two sides of Canada East and Canada West.
Interesting. I guess that kind of leads to the next question I was going to ask is, yeah, I've seen some texts that kind of indicate that this act in and of itself doesn't really advance much until responsible government, right? It doesn't really change much of the structural problems that exist in Canada. Yes, there is the name change that you bring up, and that's definitely an interesting point that I hadn't really considered. But do you buy into this idea that really the act doesn't mean much? It can almost be considered a failure until you add this element, this democratic element to it that we're going to talk about a bit later of responsible government.
Absolutely. Because like you said, you don't really have responsible government through most of the 1840s. So even though you do create the province of Canada in 1841, and like we talked about earlier with the governor general, more or less ruling like a king in many ways, you didn't have that, what we would call responsible government, something that we, you know, have to this day until 1848 or 1849. And so, yeah, nothing really would change from how things were before, and except for some name changes, how some things were done. But I think for the average person, 1841 is no different from 1831 in many ways. It's the same type of thing.
Absolutely.
Oh yeah, for sure. I definitely, again, the name thing, I that's more like long-term effects taking place that go down the line more than anything else. It's never going to be something that affects day-to-day life. It's a massive amount. And I think it's the same with the Act of Union as a whole. It wasn't something that sort of made great sweeping changes, but I did think it was an important part. You have to start somewhere, you know, and this was a very important, it's a baby step, but again, a step is a step. And this sort of sets the way for the act of the responsible government later on.
Yeah, definitely. And this is actually a question for you, Craig, specifically. We talked about it a bit before we started recording. So we've been talking a lot about, we were talking a lot of, obviously, in the 1830s, and we were saying like a lot of the things that led up to the Act of Union were the rebellions and the Durham Report, all these things. And these are things that for Mac and I are an intrinsic part of living in Quebec, right? We hear about it all the time to this day. It's actually a really, like, it's ingrained into a lot of Quebec rhetoric, even to this day. Yeah. And when I was hearing some of your past episodes about the rebellions, and it was kind of interesting to me to hear about how you learned about the rebellions in Alberta, right? Mm-hmm. Was the Act of Union similar in so far as you didn't really hear about the inherent stresses that were occurring within the Act of Union, or was it something that was addressed a bit more when you were growing up in Alberta?
The Act of Union wasn't even really even covered. Like I said, okay. Before, I didn't even know about the province of Canada. Like, we knew about Upper and Lower Canada because we talked a lot about the Hudson's Bay Company, the fur trade and things like that. But the rebellions and then the union of the two, the Canada, Upper Canada, Lower Canada, was not really talked about that much. We started talking a bit more about Canada East and Canada West, but that was only in the context of Confederation. In many ways, when I was growing up, and maybe it's different now, I don't know, but in many ways growing up, it was kind of Canadian history started at 1867, and okay. That's what we focused on. And even then, we didn't really focus on a lot. But I had no idea that the rebellions even happened until I was an adult actually learning Canadian history on my own.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Does knowing about it now kind of, how does that change your view of like the history of Canada, knowing that this is something that was taking place? Does this change it any? Or?
Yeah, absolutely. It changes it an immense amount, because I think as Canadians, we like to think, well, we became a country not like the United States who went to war. But then when you look back at, you know, the early history with the rebellions and then the province of Canada, and obviously something you'll get to with like burning down the parliament buildings, mm-hmm. we went through growing pains. We very much were clashing. We had battles, but we don't focus on that. We kind of focus years down the road. 1867, we signed a piece of paper. So it definitely does change that, because it shows that we didn't all just kind of, we were coexisting and we all got together around the table and said, you know what, let's make a country. And everyone's like, yeah, hurrah, great, this is a great idea, I'm 100% in favor of this. It was a struggle. It was battles and burning down buildings. And we had changed the capital, what, 6-7 times in yep. the space of 20 years before we settled on Ottawa.
Because it's the middle.
Exactly.
Straight up. And,
yeah, it's because of smack dab in the middle between, I think, like Kingston and Quebec. And so it changes everything, because it says, well, we did sign a piece of paper to create Canada, but we went through a lot before that. We had our rebellious teenage years in the 1830s and the 1840s to eventually get to the point where we would, you know, do kind of a peaceful creation of Canada. But it wasn't a total peaceful creation if you look back at just going to the 1830s, not to mention even farther back.
Yeah, totally. It's interesting. We didn't really bring it up, the you mentioned the parliament burning. Have you ever heard about that one, Mac?
I don't think so, no. Oh, maybe so in passing. Fun.
Okay, it's so great because it represents everything we're talking about in like a single event.
Love it.
So as Craig, this is such a tangent, but okay.
Let's do it.
So basically, as Craig was saying, the capital during the era of the province of Canada basically flopped between Kingston and Montreal. Well, no, at first it was chosen to be Kingston. Sorry, that's not true. In 1840, 41, and then in 1844, it became Montreal. And it stayed Montreal until 1849. because that's the year when the Governor General at the time, Lord Elgin, I think that's how you pronounce his name, I don't know, Elgin, Elgin, him, when that Governor General decided to sign another piece of paper that was called the Rebellion Losses Act. It's kind of related, I guess, to what we're talking about, because it basically said we're giving compensation to landowners in Lower Canada who had lost some property or had or suffered property damage during the rebellions that at that point had happened like 12 years ago. But what that did was get some conservatives really freaking mad. They got so pissed. They were like, what is this? We're actually giving benefits to people who rebelled against our great empire. And so they burned down Parliament in anger.
My God.
There were riots in the streets of Montreal, and Elgin was like pelted with food and stuff. And Parliament was burned down because of that piece of freaking paper that said, here, have some compensation a bit. It's insane.
But no, Canada is the peaceful country, and we never fight about anything. We're too polite for that.
Back when they, what was it, January 6th, when they were having that, I guess, insurrection in Washington, mm-hmm. With people storming the Capitol, I put the picture or a painting of the House of Commons, or the House of Commons, the Parliament being burned down. And it was to say, like, you know, it was a while ago, but, you know, we're not innocent in this. We literally burned down our seat of government. The Americans never did that. We burned down their seat of government, and then we burned down our own, of course. But
we like burning stuff here in Canada. We have to keep warm somehow.
I always like that story because it just kind of sums up every anxiety that conservatives at the time were feeling. And it kind of, it was also in part a reaction to what Elgin represented, because as we're going to talk about, it was under his governorship that we got responsible government. Right? And a lot of the Tory rhetoric against it was that it was a way to distance Canada from the empire. Right? It was a way for the reformers to move Canada away from this great empire, this great British empire, and into its own independent country like the States. And a lot of conservative elements at the time did not agree with that, even though it wasn't true. There was not really any reformers who wanted that. But yeah, I just think it's an interesting story to bring up that kind of, I guess, leads us pretty seamlessly into this idea of responsible government and what it is. But just to make sure, did anyone want to bring up anything else about the Act of Union itself? We've already been talking about it for like 45 minutes at this point.
I do think we should bring up, because I remember before when we were discussing planning this, some of the points in the actual Act of Union, the very interesting one that you brought up.
Oh yeah, go ahead.
LII. I don't know what the actual Roman numeral for that is.
52.
But yes, 52. There's so many points in this thing. What's this? 45,000 pounds to be granted permanently for the services in Schedule A and 30,000 pounds for life of Her Majesty in 5 years following for those in Schedule B?
Yeah, so basically it's saying, you know, we're giving you these greater powers in air quotes, or we're providing for, you know, this new country and stuff like that, but you still have to pay all these things to the British government, and you still have to essentially finance everything we do, even though, as Craig mentioned earlier, we're never really in Canada. We're just kind of a distant relative looking on from afar, but you still have to pay for us through these exorbitant amounts at the time. It was, as you say, thousands of dollars every session for nothing.
It's like paying rent.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's why I was just saying, like, it's kind of a dick move, but it also exactly represents what we've been talking about. Is it's a lot of this is surface level changes, but a lot of the stuff is still intrinsically tied into the functioning of government. You're taking up a lot of money from taxpayers, from all kinds of people from Canada to finance something that they don't actually care about much, or that doesn't actually involve them much.
Well, so, it's also you see things like the point 52 above it, revenues of the two provinces to form a consolidated revenue fund. That's another slap in the face to Quebec in a way, because if they end up making more money, that disappears. That doesn't go back to them.
Mm-hmm.
So absolutely. Theoretically speaking, the Quebecers make up the majority of the workforce in their population numbers, so they will probably most likely generate a lot of things to be used for revenue, but then they won't see the return of that money because they're both being consolidated into one fund.
Absolutely. And it's the same thing for debts at the time. Canada West had a much higher debt than Canada East. And that was all just consolidated into one as one fund that needed to be paid off.
We are one fund, comrade. We work together.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we build the canals in what would be Ontario, but we're going to make Quebec pay for part of it, even though they don't really use it and it doesn't really impact their trade at all.
Exactly. Yeah. It's weird in our context now. Again, at the time, within their own mindset, it makes perfect sense, I'm sure. But yeah, it's just one of those things that you're like, you look back on and it's just so obviously dripping with bad decisions. And you're like, oh, why would anyone ever agree to this? What are you even doing? But yeah, fun stuff. But yeah, great point, Mac. I forgot to bring it up. But yeah, definitely. Anything else?
No, and we could go through point by point with this thing and have a good laugh for like hours, but then we'd run out of time because Craig has to go watch the Oilers game, so better to just move along.
Hey, this is Phil Bitter from the podcast Invest in Yourself, the Digital Entrepreneurs Podcast. Have you ever wanted to be an entrepreneur? Have you heard about all those kids making money on the internet? Do you want to start making money on the internet? Go to investinyourselfpod.com, subscribe, and listen as I interview people who have actually made money online. Listen to me create a business and see if I can succeed. Catch new episodes every Tuesday at investinyourselfpod.com.
All right. So when we talk about responsible government, right, in Canada, there's kind of two narratives that are often brought up. The one that happens in Nova Scotia, and we mostly talk about through the likes of Joseph Howe, who you can check out our whole episode on him. And there's basically the narrative with the Baldwin and LaFontaine government in the province of Canada. And we'll kind of touch a bit upon both and compare and contrast, see if there's any significant differences, because I think that's an interesting exercise, if nothing else. But obviously, starting us off, Craig, how would you define responsible government? What does it mean exactly to want responsible government in Canada, and why is it important?
I think the biggest definition would be responsible government is, it's like you said, the executive of the cabinet, and the support is not coming, it's not coming from the monarch or the representation of the monarch. It's coming from the executive and the cabinet. That's where the main decisions are being made by that point. It's not the governor general saying, this is what I want and this is what's going to happen, or this is what the British aristocrats want or Queen Victoria wants or anything like that. It's saying, this is what the people want. And it's a much more functioning democracy rather than a very flawed democracy that we would have had from 1841 to 1848.
Yeah, exactly. The relative structure stays the same. You still have the House of Assembly. You still have the cabinet. Exactly. You still have all of these positions that are still in place, but based off of a system essentially of confidence, right? You hear that sometimes even in Canadian politics today, where you say a vote of no confidence, for example, where essentially the House says, okay, we don't agree. We don't trust whatever the government is doing right now, and we can vote them out of power. Obviously, you can't vote the governor out of power because they're chosen by the Queen to represent herself, but the structure of government can change if it is decided that the people, as represented by the House, do not trust that government. Right. It's, as you said before, very, very similar to what you have today. Right? It's essentially laying the groundwork for our modern form of democracy. Now, the major difference is obviously the governor general, while still abusing their power significantly, as we've recently seen, is not actually as important as they used to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, I think there's a few things that need to be established about how the province of Canada was actually operating before we actually go into self-government. Ezra, we mentioned a lot of the stuff, a lot of the issues with the Act of Union, but there's a lot of underlying factors that go beyond just the province of Canada that had an impact on the obtaining of responsible government. Right? Namely, one of the things we hear a lot about is a change in economics and a change in demography. So it's during this time that two things happened. One, there was a much bigger increase in what we now consider to be somewhat of a middle class in the British Empire. So that in itself would put a lot of pressure onto the aristocracy and these old systems of power within the British Empire, right? Because now you have more than just a simple worker who can hardly read and write, right? You actually have people that sometimes have an education and who have a voice through newspapers, through poetry, through legislation, but that don't represent the so-called old guard. Right? And this is where people like Robert Baldwin, Louis-Polyte Lafontaine, Joseph Howe, to an extent, right? This is what these people represent. That they're an educated mass, if you will. Second of all, in terms of economy, the British were moving less towards a hands-on approach to their economy of dictating exactly what kind of resources went where through laws, through legislation. The most famous example at the time is something like the Corn Laws in Ireland, where you had very specific instructions that the Irish could only have, at that point, it was just all referred to as corn, but grains like potatoes and stuff like that, that's all they could eat. And everything else was to be sent out throughout the empire. Right? It was a very, very determined economy and planned. But as the 1840s came along, you had a shift towards what is essentially free trade. And this leads to much more of a, obviously freer model, but it leads to a much greater exchange of ideas and resources. And it shifts the power away once again from non-elected officials. Right? The policymakers have less of a hold, and it's more of, in this case, merchants, or again, kind of this middle class. Which I think is something that's kind of overlooked when we think of obtaining of responsible government, is those two elements. Personally, that's not something that I ever learned about before I was studying today. It was mostly just like, and then Baldwin and Lafontaine came and everything was rosy and peachy. But
no, yeah. I definitely think you're right. There's a lot of factors in the rest of the world that are at play. Again, we're seeing the full effects of the Industrial Revolution coming into play from Britain. And so the factoryman and the factory worker suddenly gain a much larger role.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's the mercantilism is a much less, it's not as needed as it is anymore, due to the fact that they have these factories that can now mass produce and start pumping out all these objects and materials. So it's a bit more willingness to go hands off almost.
I mean, there was one that I also saw. I don't think we will have time to much talk about it today, but even mass immigrations by, for example, the Irish and other more destitute populations at that time was a significant factor as well, because a lot of people suddenly saw what the effects of the kind of fringes of British economic policy was, because suddenly you had droves of starving people arriving in Canada because of those very laws in part, right? Such as the Corn Laws, that had a direct impact on this kind of thing. And I think that definitely has an impact on how people perceive those in power when they see the full effects of it, even though it's not explicitly stated necessarily.
Well, for sure. No, but there's a definition, because now before they were relying on their pretty poetry to say about how Canada was and how Canada was doing. This is something we do the literature focus, so we read some of the poetry, and a lot of it is similar in that it's always Canada's a very beautiful, very natural place. Again, this very idealized version of Canada, when the reality is quite different. It is quite shocking. You see the destitution, the difference in cultures, and the clashes and tensions that this created. It's not like this territory was one large national park. This was a place with its own struggles that people were still not recognizing.
Like I said, I agree with you with the growing middle class and people becoming more educated and wanting more of a say in the government. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much the fact that, like, when in 1841, when they first kind of united the two provinces, all the focus was on Ontario and Quebec, and then obviously some into the Maritimes. And then by the time we're starting to get to the 1850s, we're starting to see the slow movement of people into what will one day be Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Alberta, and into British Columbia. So I don't know how much that had an effect on the idea of responsible government, because that was still very much territories or colonies themselves. But I don't know if they were looking longer term of the fact that, well, eventually we've got to kind of bring all of these people together into some sort of type of country. So I don't know if when they finally made the move to actually be a responsible government, if that played a role at all, but it was something that was happening at the time for sure.
I know for some of the time we were mentioning the Northwest Rebellions, for example, before, it's much, much, much past what we're talking about now, but I think it, if I remember correctly, a lot of the rhetoric that you saw behind that was exactly that, was this idea that the Métis were not at all consulted in these democratic processes at all, even as far back as the 1840s and 50s when they were being moved on into their territory. And so that was already a point of contention. So while I haven't studied that question specifically, I'm sure someone thought of it exactly. Yeah.
I think it really was, because you had Selkirk come in and, you know, he stops the pemmican distribution, which causes the pemmican war between the Northwest Company and the Hudson's Bay Company. And then you did start to have more of these English settlers settling in what would be Manitoba and saying, well, this is how you guys have to live now, and this is what we want you to do. And the Métis had been there for, you know, half a century or more by that point as a kind of a distinct culture. And that was very probably... even like you said, at that point, 1840s, 1850s, we're already feeling like these people are coming in and kind of just telling us what to do, and we have no say in what we can do or how we can do it. In most cases, they just ignored what the English told them to do anyways. But still, it was kind of the first seed of that we would see in 1869. I mean, it's not a huge distance. 1869 to 1848 is... you know, not a huge amount of time.
It's 21 years.
21 years. Yeah.
Baby could be born and then become legal to drink in that time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's really what's important, is the legal drinking age right here.
Listen.
Anyway, I guess we can start by talking about Joseph Howe in Nova Scotia for a bit. See how he approached, he and the reformers, obviously. The underlying idea, by the way, we always mention like one or two people. It's a group of people always that are involved in these movements. It's never just a single person, but it's easier for the purposes of discussion to talk about one person. So when we're talking about responsible government in Nova Scotia, which is often recognized as the first place in Canada to have achieved it, which is, you know, pretty cool. So Mac, do you remember where we left Joseph, where we left him last time we talked about him?
Oh, he had won his case.
Yep.
And the surprise, like the major surprise that deserves to be made into a film. I know. And then so he became he got into politics, just started working as a reformer, didn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much. Like, he made a 6-hour speech and reformers all across Nova Scotia are like, this guy, we need someone who can talk the ear off of some magistrate somewhere and gain us responsible. Like, this guy knows what he's talking about. If he can talk for 6 hours straight at his own trial, we need this dude. But yeah, pretty much. So he would join the reformers soon after. And he would pretty much make a career out of the obtention of responsible government. I don't know. Have you ever covered Joseph Howe on your show, Craig?
The most that I've covered Joseph Howe was as a kind of part of like a sidebar to some of the prime ministers, like John Sparrow, David Thompson, and especially when I'm talking about Confederation. Yeah. And Nova Scotia's initial resistance to joining Canada and the anti-Confederation party and such. But I haven't focused like primarily on him yet, no.
Right. So it's kind of fascinating that he had such a long career that he would go from pre-Act of Union into Confederation and anti-Confederation to an extent, right? It's fascinating. We'll get there eventually in like 20 years at the rate that we're going on this show. But in essence, he would make his career as a reformer. And for the longest time, it was very much a slow process, right? But how, if you'll remember, Mac, he had kind of this advantage in that he ran his own newspaper, which was the most circulated newspaper in Nova Scotia at the time, right? The Nova Scotian. He could print his own news. He could distribute his own news. He basically was a politician with his own mass media. Right?
I remember that because we looked at the thing. He says to the editor of the paper, and it's basically him writing to himself.
That's exactly it. Yeah. That's really using your medium to the best.
That's some big brain plays right there.
Yeah. But pretty much he would use his newspaper to, not only to argue his case, but to very much kind of prop himself up and his reformers up as well, right? He would basically use it as a way to say, hey, look, other people in the House of Assembly, clearly people want this because look, they're buying my paper that's talking about this very issue. Off, it's flying off the shelves. It's selling like gangbusters. So obviously people want responsible government. As you say, Mackey was kind of a circuitous thing in the end, but it achieved its purpose nonetheless. But he would actually become provincial secretary not long before the responsible government was granted in Nova Scotia. So in 1848, he would become provincial secretary. And from there, it would pretty much be a bit more useful than his newspaper to enact change in a more direct capacity. Right, he had a bit more of an influence and a say within the cabinet. He had a bit more of a direct link to the governor, to the people in power.
It's going to be the dumb comparison again, but it's true. You can do a lot more. That's what Stalin did when he No, it is though. When he became the secretary, that's how he used his position to come into power.
Right.
Obviously, Howe had different motives. Thank God, he had more benevolent. But he had, I can see how that position would lend him his credibility, because you are sort of the one that spreads the notice of the meeting time, who needs to be where and when. So I can definitely see where the power would start to shift. It just goes to show, to enact real change, you have to participate in the government.
It's exactly this idea of, it's not what you know, it's who you know.
That as well, yeah.
that saying doesn't come from nowhere. It's all well and fine to argue through your newspaper. A lot of it, I feel, will be kind of undermined by the fact that people are buying your newspaper regardless, right? Or it's a lot of the same people that are going to be buying your newspaper. If Tories don't want to hear about it, they're just not going to buy your paper. So you're basically kind of arguing in your own echo chamber to an extent. But as someone who is provincial secretary and eventually actually elected as a majority, he actually leads the reformers to a majority in the House of Assembly right around that same time, right? That's where you actually have a voice, because you have that direct contact. Absolutely. It is interesting that this is just a side note. He actually, before getting the majority of the seats in the House of Assembly of Nova Scotia with his reformers, he did try basically what we were talking about earlier with the two joint premiers. He tried to have a coalition throughout the 1840s with the Tories, and it really never went anywhere, right? It's exactly what we thought maybe could have been interesting with the joint premiers if they were from a different mindset, but this was just a no-go from the start. He never went anywhere. From what I understood, as a coalition with the Tories, it was just nothing, right? Which, I know, I don't know what to think of it beyond the fact that, well, he tried. Good on him. But yeah, what's interesting about, I think, talking about Joseph Howe, right? Because once he achieves the majority of the House, the governorship pretty much has no choice but to grant responsible government at that point, right? He had been a thorn in the British system's side for nigh on 10 years at that point. And the voting power of Nova Scotians had given basically the reason to say, like, okay, we get it. Okay, for a brief moment, like at this point, we're not so daft that we can't see that if we don't grant responsible government, that we're not going to be burned at the stake. Right? So we will grant you responsible government. There was also a bunch of stuff apparently happening in Britain at the time in which there was a change of government towards a more progressive.
I could see that being a solid point to make.
Yeah, totally. But one of the things that Howe always said, and he would make a career out of this, is we obtained responsible government without breaking a single window. That's kind of his catchphrase. Kind of a jab at the Canadas, like kind of throwing shade at it. saying like, hey, guess what we did? We got it before you, and we ain't got no Papineau.
We didn't burn down our parliament either. What?
Parliament hadn't burned down yet, but yeah.
Rebellions who? Rebellions what?
That's a really, really funny power move. Yeah, I don't know. I just wanted to open up with how it's a very straightforward obtention of responsible government. There's not much to say about him. There's not much conflict. I don't know. Is there anything you wanted to add? I think it's just an interesting way to open up to that discussion more than anything else.
I think it's kind of weird that he's not remembered more in Canada, at least in, I don't know how it is in Eastern Canada, but in Western Canada, if you think of somebody named Howe, you think of Gordie Howe. I mean,
yes.
You don't think of Joseph Howe, but he had such a massive impact on the eventual formation of Canada and even Confederation. And then, you know, he was part of the government right after Confederation. Mm-hmm. He was one of the first ministers from Nova Scotia, but at least in most of Canada, I don't think he's remembered as much as he should be.
No, absolutely not. You were asking if he was taught here? No, the answer is absolutely not. I have a feeling he's mostly relegated to that province. There should be a movie just about his trial. It's fantastic. But
like, oh my God, like reading the things he said and the way he talked, it was beautiful.
Oh yeah, the guy was a skilled orator. It's not a surprise that he managed to lead the reformers that well. Like, he was fantastic. His poetry is another thing, but he was fantastic. But yeah, I guess moving on from there, how would you start talking about, Craig, I guess, the obtention of responsible government in Canada itself? Where would you start with that?
That's a good question. I mean,
I think we tried to set up a lot of the elements, but like, how do you begin to approach that? I guess
it's tough because it's such a huge topic. Like when I did an episode on the province of Canada, there's just so much to it, and the responsible government, and then people like Baldwin who become a major figure afterwards with LaFontaine. It's hard to kind of know exactly where to kind of start that from.
Yeah. I think, okay, so I was kind of thinking over it as we were talking. We talked a lot about like the economic aspects of the union and stuff like that. We already covered that a bit. I think the best way to start here is to come back to this idea of the joint premiership and remind ourselves that it wasn't really going anywhere. It was kind of this circle jerk, if you like. It's a weird way of saying it, right? But it was basically either reformers, Anglo reformers, or Tories that were in power, and very little was actually being done. Right now, come to realize for a lot of the French people that a lot of the point of the Act of Union was to assimilate them, as we've touched upon many times already. Right? And it's at that moment that the need for partnership is kind of recognized. It says, okay, especially from a Canada East point of view, saying if we don't at least partner up with someone, a reformer in this case of Canada West, they're just going to swallow us whole, right? So might as well have a leg up and try to cooperate, right? Because it's better to be half of something than nothing within a giant hole, right? So I think that's a great place to start, as good a place to start as any, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's in this circumstance that, as you say, Robert Baldwin and Louis-Polyte Lafontaine, representing Canada West and Canada East respectively, are going to appear, right? Mm-hmm. One's a francophone, one's an anglophone, both are reformers. And already in 1841, they're going to form one of the first joint governments in the Act of Union, but that government is not going to go anywhere, right? And they're not going to be reelected as the major voices of responsible government until 1848. Right? Before we get into that, I think it's kind of useful to talk about who Baldwin and Lafontaine were, not just say, they're reformers. Mac, I'll bring this one back to you. Do you know who they are?
The reformers?
Yeah, Baldwin and Lafontaine, or the reformers themselves.
Lafontaine is such a common name. I hear it all the time, but I can't say I know the Lafontaine we're talking about.
You pass his underground bridge probably going off of...
Yeah, exactly. It's one of the same with Baldwin.
What can you say? Let's say Robert Baldwin to start.
Well, I know that, like you said, he was born in Upper Canada and Lafontaine was born in Lower Canada. And they really did kind of work together to create this, what would lead eventually to Confederation. I know that a lot of people did really like Baldwin. Especially his voters, they respected him. The Orange Order at the time was a very prominent organization and could influence a lot of things. And he was very in their face. He wasn't scared of them. And I know that won him a lot of loyalty because they were intimidating his supporters. And he stood up to them, and that got him a lot of loyalty. It gained him a lot of power, which he was then able to use working with LaFontaine and doing a lot of good things to kind of lead us to Confederation. I think they, the two of them worked together to kind of get French as an official language again, things like that. But yeah, I mean, and then I think he died before Canada became a country, unfortunately. So he wasn't able to kind of see the end result of the work that he was putting in, but it definitely laid the groundwork for it.
Yeah, that's pretty much like a really good overview of the guy. It is kind of fascinating to me to look at kind of a family history, see where these ideas come from. His father was also apparently quite the reformer. Although he was Irish, we'll forgive him, I think. But he was like this stereotypically flamboyant Irish liberal who apparently just railed constantly against the British. And that I always love that image in my mind, stereotype or not, of just this angry Irishman being like, damn you, empire.
Damn you, Brits.
Yeah, like that's kind of where a lot of his ideas apparently come from, even though as a child he was apparently quite introverted and not as flamboyant. He would get a lot of these political ideas and this taste for politics from an early age from his father. And Mac, this will interest you a bit more. He was also a poet, although apparently not a particularly skilled one either.
Are any of them?
So far, I don't think we've met like one skilled poet politician.
Oh, I thought we were talking poets in general. Whoops.
Wow, brutal. It does show, I've read a lot of criticism of him where it was basically this fact that he was more introverted and was interested in poetry while being a lawyer kind of demonstrate more of his idealism more than anything else. He seemed to be very much shooting for the stars, having these bigger ideas and having these more these less concrete and pragmatic ideas of what Canada could be. And it was more like, let's shoot for the biggest thing possible, at that time responsible government. But it really is kind of interesting for me that you get with him this more idealism, this more idealistic figure, whereas from what I've read about La Fontaine, he was much more of a pragmatic figure. And I think that's, you know, one of the things that makes this partnership so interesting to me, because with La Fontaine, you get this lawyer by trade who also entered politics in the 1830s like Baldwin, but he was much more of a supporter of people like Papineau, right, who did advance a lot of these actions. Apparently, he wasn't too keen on the violence aspect of Papineau, and he was apparently, La Fontaine, opposed to union at first, which makes sense considering what we know about it. But eventually, like I mentioned, he would see it as the best outcome for the survival of French Canadians. And especially if responsible government were to be achieved. It was the kind of thing of, you have to give us a voice if we want us to succeed in this province that for the majority of, not in this province, in this continent that for the majority is English speaking. Mm-hmm. The best way I guess we could approach it is, what did you see in your own research, Craig, about the way they went about obtaining responsible government, right? So we know a bit about the two of them. They joined up out of necessity. Why? How did they go about it, actually? Like, what was their reform? What was their actual action looking like?
Well, like I said, the creation of getting French as an official language again, because it had been mm-hmm. removed for the Union Act. So I don't know too much about exactly how they went about it. One kind of interesting thing, it's not really related to this, but with these two people working together with the English and the French working together, you kind of see it sometimes later in like our prime ministers, especially the Francophone ones with like Sir Wilfrid Laurier, who kind of he housed with English people, he had a French background, or Louis Saint-Laurent, who had an Irish mother and a French father, and it kind of gave that unique perspective of these two different worlds in Canada. And so they kind of seem like, you know, the ideal of what Canada can be with these two worlds kind of working together. But as for how they went about creating the responsible government and stuff like that I'm not too familiar on.
For the second part, like for their second mandate, it's relatively similar to what you saw in Nova Scotia with Joseph Howe. I bring it up because there's a bit of political maneuvering that goes on with Baldwin and La Fontaine, in their first mandate, in that La Fontaine at first isn't quite popular, or at least he's not aiming, or he's not on track to be voted into power as a premier. And so there's a bit of maneuvering that goes on by Baldwin to be like, okay, well, how about you take this like cushy seat of reforming for your second, because they were elected in 1841. Then there was a vote in 1842. It's like, okay, so for this election here, take this really cushy seat and you'll be guaranteed an election, like for sure. And from there, we'll be able to join your government. And while that first period of government didn't ultimately go anywhere, I do think that it kind of emblematizes what they're willing to do, or a bit of the backwards maneuvering of, okay, well, we got to stack the system in our favor as much as possible. Use the best of our abilities of the law, of how our structure of government works, to be able to get into power and then talk to people and be, you know, as we're saying with Howe, be in direct contact with these people. But ultimately, you know, this is another case of something that is intrinsically tied to, as we were saying with Howe, the rise of newspapers, your ability to use the full potential of the medium to your disposal. And also something that helped him with their second mandate, right, is the actual instability of the elections. If you look at a list of the joint premierships that were happening at that time, there was basically one every year or two. There was absolutely no stability in the government at that point. Every year or two, there was like it was just nonstop elections. And from what I understood, Baldwin and La Fontaine would basically use that to their advantage and argue on a basis of, we want the most stable government possible. We want something that lasts. And that's how we're going to be arguing for responsible government. And it would really work, because in 1847, 48, they would sweep with one of the biggest majorities the province of Canada had ever seen at that point. They would just take so many seats. And by that point, it had just been after Nova Scotia had been attributed responsible government, and that the province of Canada had been given a new governor, the aforementioned Lord Elgin, and who was much more progressive. And when he saw that this sweep had happened, he was just like, all right, you got it. There's no point in denying it anymore. Much like in Nova Scotia, here, you've proven your point. And ultimately, they were kind of right, because they would stay on for the longest a government had stayed on up until that point. It would actually be very stable in the province of Canada for like 5 years. And then it would kind of all go to shit after, but that's another issue. But it's kind of fascinating to me that it's not an approach that I would have thought of happening. You often hear about these firebrands or people who are much more interested in, you know, promoting these more pragmatic actions, and like this Papineau that we were mentioning that La Fontaine was very much inspired by. But a lot of it was based off of what they saw as common sense, right? It's like, you want a stable government. You want someone who will actually represent people. And it's the most logical argument to make. So of course it would work. Like, it kind of baffles me that it's so simple. You know, they would actually apparently be quite good with other stuff, like establishing better school systems, founding the University of Toronto. They would actually do quite a bit as a government, the official languages that you were talking about, Craig. So they weren't just like a one-trick pony. They actually did have a lot of progressive ideas in their mind. But yeah, I thought that was kind of a fun way to go about it.
It's two people that in Western Canada we know very little about.
Okay.
Not really talked about it much at all. So, but I imagine like in Quebec and everything, they're much more prominent in your school system for sure.
Mm-hmm. I mean, La Fontaine, as Max said, literally has his name everywhere. We have a bridge named after him. We have...
we have a park. We do have a park.
Yes, that's true. So having understood this, right? So having gone through this cursory glance of responsible government in these two places, I guess my first question would be, is Howe right in saying that, you know, Nova Scotia gained responsible government without breaking a single window? Or, and this is my contention, do you think he would have achieved it had there not been rebellions in the Canadas before? Right? Do you think that pushed a lot of the things in his favor despite him being more peaceful than the Canadas?
Yeah, I would say that not even just in Nova Scotia, but everywhere else. But for sure, because you've seen an example of these rebellions that could have gone very differently. They, you know, it could have been the rebellions were successful and it would have changed Canada forever. So I think, I don't know how successful he would have been with creating a responsible government without having that example of, you know, this is what can happen if we don't have a responsible government. And so he is right in that, you know, there are no broken windows, but even that is still founded on the foundation of broken windows. And it's like we talked about earlier with Canada becoming a country, we could say, well, we became a country without breaking any windows. But again, it's being influenced on revolutions that certainly did kill people and burn buildings down and burn parliament buildings down and things like that.
Yeah. It's a very narrow view of what you actually achieved.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I don't know, Mac, did you have anything to add on that one?
I think it's all part of this mythology we have in Canada of sweeping things under the rug. Like we talked about in the previous episode of Black History, where we said, oh, we're in Canada, we weren't like the States with our slavery issues and slavery problems. Look at us. We were the place where all the slaves went to. It's the same. It's a similar situation of we're the peaceful nation. We're going to sweep the rebellions under the rug. We're going to sweep. Look at what Joseph Howe did. Good job, Joseph Howe. Man, look at what Joseph Howe did.
Yeah, exactly. Look at this Baldwin and LaFontaine type. They're actually doing it properly. They got responsible government.
Right.
But it wouldn't have been possible, I think, without, or at least that quickly, without the rebellions.
Because
I don't think the British Empire was ready before that to grant any form of responsible government.
History has shown us time and time again, you have to get a little violent to get what you want. As far as these like massive changes or any change, real changes in government, you have to be a little bit aggressive at some point.
This episode is brought to you in part by Revolution. So yes. Go to your local.
you're really right with how, you know, Britain wouldn't have released control. Because even after we got Confederation, it was still, you know, Britain still picked our Governor General. It was always some lord or somebody in royalty. You know, it wasn't until the 1950s we actually got some guy actually born in Canada as our Governor General. Yep. We didn't do our first treaty without Britain kind of looking over our shoulder till the 1920s. So yeah, without those rebellions, I think eventually we would have had Canada. I mean, it just, you know, things go that way, but it would have been very different and it could have been as much as, you know, 50 years down the road. So like you said, in Nova Scotia and then the greater context, Canada, the rebellions were necessary and had to happen to kind of create Canada eventually.
Yeah, absolutely. I think also a big, this is me extrapolating. I made no research into this specific thing. It's just something that came to me. You know, in 1848, there were a lot of rebellions that were happening across Europe, right? We mentioned Ireland earlier. There were a lot happening there. If I remember correctly, in Germany, in France, there was a rebellion and they would happen again and again. Like the 19th century, that mid 19th century was spurred by a great deal of movements like that, popular movements, right? You were laughing earlier, Mac, throughout the episode of Russia and Soviet and socialism and stuff like that. But
oh, yeah.
That's something that was legitimately happening at that time, right? These ideas were gaining a lot more traction. And you saw them throughout Europe, in the States also, and these mass movements that were happening. And there's a part of me that has a feeling that the British Empire was very much influenced by what they were seeing and saying, okay, not only is it unstable right now in Canada, we want to make sure it doesn't happen again like it did at that point 10 years prior. So here's responsible government. You got what you want, kind of.
Really? Yeah, Britain was ahead of, or they were smart enough to see the signs looking at what had happened, and they wanted to avoid that sort of thing, you know, because they still had their powerful empire and they wanted to kind of keep it that way for as long as possible. Mm-hmm. And I think they finally got smart and what they were doing was not working. They couldn't just assimilate the French people. They couldn't just try and let, they decided, hey, why not let Canada try and actually figure out for themselves what they want to do for once.
Yeah.
Surprise, surprise, if you ask people what they need and you listen to them when they tell you.
Yeah, there was something interesting that I read also. I was reading a book on, you know, forms of nationalism in Canada from the 1760s to today. And there was a whole section where they were talking about this period that we were talking about today. And I thought it was an interesting question to raise, because while the act of union itself, and to an extent responsible government, were not explicit acts of nationalism, right? I don't think anybody was really proposing like, yes, we need to create a Canadian nation, and this is how we're going to strongly create one. It's interesting what that book was bringing up. I forget the name. It'll be linked in the description. But what they were saying of the Act of Union itself in the Durham Report was as a result of a kind of nationalism, right? It's very interesting that it was a reaction to nationalism to want to tone it down, in this case, majorly French nationalism, or to an extent, as Craig mentioned, the Republic of Canada, that kind of nationalism to be distinct from the British Empire. And that ultimately, while it wasn't explicitly something that spawned nationalism, I think there's something to be said about the fact that it was reacting to that, and that ultimately down the line, it would be very much influential in how many nationalists viewed Canada, right? As this kind of power that brings together so many different ideas or peoples, right? And or how they romantically view Confederation, right? This kind of precursor to Confederation as a union, as a democracy. So I just find it kind of interesting that you have this middle ground of nothing that is both influenced by and influences greatly this form of nationalism that we see in Canada. I don't know if you had any thoughts about that, or if that was just me rambling for 2 minutes about nothing.
Like you said, you can even see it all the way down to when you were talking about the, you know, the linking of different nationalities and stuff. You know, Canada becoming the first multicultural nation by government mandate in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. So that kind of that idea or view going all the way well into the 20th century. And then, like you said, influencing the creation of Canada. And I think maybe we try and forget that there were rebellions. We like to think that, oh, we did responsible government. There was a little hiccup in 1838. But other than that, you know, we kind of just was a gradual creation of Canada. There was no rebellions. There was no burning down parliament buildings or anything like that.
Yep. Were there any final thoughts that either of you wanted to bring here about anything that we've covered, whether the relation between the Act of Union and responsible government, just one or the other, further questions that this kind of incites, things that we didn't necessarily bring up? Was there anything that you wanted to kind of end on?
For me, when I talked about it on my show a while ago, like we had talked about here as well, with the French vastly outnumbering the English at the start of this. And then by the end of it, by the time we get to 1861, you know, we're starting to move in towards Confederation, the English vastly outnumber the French. And I think it's really telling that initially it was like, well, no, let's have everything split right down the middle, 42-42. But then as we get more and more English, the English are more, then they wanted to have representation by population, because now they did have the population. And, you know, it could be seen as, well, we're finally giving you guys what you asked for 20 years ago, but now we outnumber you 2-1. So,
yeah, it's kind of fascinating that, you know, this Baldwin La Fontaine moment is kind of seen as this epitome of cooperation, but it would really not happen again for a really long time in terms of like the lifespan of people. Looking back on it now, it was like 20 years later with MacDonald and Cartier, for example. But a lot of it was just, yeah, okay, it happened once, as you say, and moving on. Now we can get back to regular business.
We had our moment across the aisle shaking hands. Let's get back to the fun stuff.
I do think it is kind of interesting to see, though, that they got they did actually get the responsible government even after the English outnumbered them. So it was just that fact to me does speak a bit to how we're starting to see the change in identity to a more Canadian identity versus British colonials, French colonials. These people are starting to shift their mindset away from in French and English and more Canadian and then Britain.
Yeah.
I think absolutely. We can start to see that sort of shift start to happen here.
Absolutely. We were saying at first, I remember texting this to you. I was kind of laughing when saying like, wow, it's incredible how little the Act of Union mattered until responsible government was achieved. It's like, in terms of the sense of, well, you know, it didn't change much structurally until you added that element, but you're right, Mac, in that, yeah, you suddenly lay the groundwork for the foundation of the modern Canadian state.
Right. Well, I like my analogy and my metaphors, but it's like a car, you know, you can have the perfect engine. If you don't have any wheels, you're not going anywhere. It's the same with the wheels. You can have great wheels, but if you don't have any engine, they're just going to fall over and sit there.
I think that's the perfect analogy to end on. The government wheels falling is a off car. Of the British Empire. Well, I mean, Craig, thank you very much for being on the show with us today. I know this runs longer than your regular show, so I'm sure you're tired. But we made it in time for the Oilers game, so there's that.
We did, yeah, that's good.
That's what really matters in Canada.
Do you want to plug your shows a bit before you go?
Yeah, I guess there's Pucks and Cups, which comes out once a week every Sunday, and that looks at early hockey history. So if you want to hear about people like King Clancy and Newsy Lalonde, and when the Montreal Canadiens almost moved to Cleveland, then that's the podcast for you. Then I have From John to Justin, which is every Friday, where I'm just looking at every single prime minister, and it's actually really interesting. People seem to enjoy it. And then Canadian History X, Mondays and Wednesdays, I release interview episodes with historians, authors, famous Canadians, whoever I happen to pick up. And every Saturday is a longer episode that looks at events or people in history, in our history. And half of those always focus on Indigenous history. So it's kind of a nice mix there. And they're on all podcast platforms. And you can find every single episode I've ever done. I just released episode 300 today, actually. And you can go to my website. Yeah, you can go to my website, CanadaEHX.com. And yeah, that's everything's right there.
Fantastic. And as always, if you want to support the show, you can check out all the links that we have in the description. We have a Patreon page with extra episodes and Atlas episodes. We have a recommended reading page where you can have affiliate links about the books that we talk about. There's not going to be a book this week because you can't buy The Act of Union, but
you can read it if you want.
If you can understand it, go ahead.
Yeah. There's a book version of the Durham Report, and it's fascinating. It's like an abridged version with commentary. It's so great. I bought it. I love it. But yeah, I guess with that being said, thank you again, Craig. And we'll see you all next time on Historia Canadiana or over on one of Craig's three shows. Cheers, everyone.